Welcome back to Looks Like New, the radio podcast of the Media Economist Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Julia Martins, and this is the show where we ask old questions about new technology, exploring how the tools shaping our world connect to timeless concerns about power, justice, and human flourishing. Today, we are exploring questions that political philosophers have wrestled with for centuries. Who gets to make the rules? What makes governance legitimate? And how do ordinary people build real collective power over the systems that shape their lives? These aren't new questions, but they're playing out right now in places we might not think to look. The subreddits, where volunteer moderators debate policy in Discord calls, the Mastodon servers, whose administrators decide in an instant which communities their members can or can't talk to, and the open protocols quietly determining who controls your identity, your feed, and your corner of the internet. Our guest is Soyeon Wang, a postdoctoral research associate at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University, where she works with the Princeton Human-Computer Interaction Group as a Siegel Research Fellow. Soyeon studies how everyday people can have more agency in the technologies pervading their socioeconomic and political lives. Her research focuses on community-based models of organizing and governance, how groups of people set rules, build norms, and design tools that help them respond collectively to the opportunities and risks of technology. She has investigated why online communities adopt the rules they do, how decentralized social media platforms distribute and concentrate power through their very architecture, and what it really means when a community moderator decides to block an entire server from their world. What makes Soyeon's work so distinctive is that she takes seriously the idea that small, overlooked online communities are doing something genuinely important, not just managing content, but experimenting with collective self-governance in real time. And by studying those experiments carefully, she surfaced insights that matter far beyond any individual platform. Soyeon, welcome to Looks Like New. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Let's start with where your curiosity comes from. You describe your research interests as wanting to help everyday people have more agency in technologies that shape their lives. That's a big animating commitment. What drew you to this work? Was there a particular experience or question that made you think this is where you needed to focus your energy?
Yeah, so I don't know if there was a singular moment that really drew me in this direction. A kind of sideways answer is maybe that, like, I had always been quite interested in politics as a question of how power is distributed and who gets a hold of and gets to make the decisions. And in college, I studied government, and a lot of that was because I had this longer term interest in why ideologies become, like, really widespread and powerful, which is kind of a tangent. But at the time, my mom had convinced me to double major in information science. And I think my parents were basically seriously concerned about my job prospects because I was doing the humanities thing where I am, like, basically spending all my time thinking about 20th century Europe and going to weird seminars, which was really, really fun. But then I started the information science major as well. And I got to take all these super interesting classes about technology and power in our world today. And I think more broadly, I started seeing some of the same struggles that I was seeing in my government classes about what does it mean to have meaningful voice in one's life. And, you know, as a really simple example, when you're a student and you're learning some of the really basic computational techniques like natural language processing, you realize how these really fundamental, like, choices about what to filter, what keywords to prioritize, et cetera, like, these are basically value-laden choices that one makes as a designer or engineer. And on the other hand, this is also, like, largely invisible and inaccessible to the broader population of folks who get affected by it, right? So it's like all these similar questions about who gets to make those decisions and how does that impact people's lives. And I think personally, I also care a lot about my own sense of freedom, or, like, my own sense of my, like, right to self-determination, both individually and collectively. And so this has kind of been like a guiding principle for me in general.
And that continued to inform your work throughout your career?
I think so. It's like one of those, I mean, I think when we were talking a bit about doing this podcast, I often like think about like, why am I doing the work that I do? And you kind of realize that there are consistent threads that motivate the work. And it's only in retrospect that you realize how clear that is.
A lot of your research centers on online communities, subreddits, fandom wikis, Mastodon servers. To someone who hasn't studied them, maybe not familiar, those might sound like very niche hobby spaces, but you treat them more like governance laboratories. Why? Why is that? And what are they actually doing that deserves that kind of attention?
Yeah, I think I have two answers to this. The first is that I think that we are so used to these giant platforms now that anything else seems kind of niche, right? But online communities are kind of the OG of more mainstream and popular internet use broadly, like listservs, like bulletin board systems, and so on. I was actually like a little too young when those came out. But when I was a kid around 8 or 9, I remember my sister having MSN Messenger and AOL and stuff. And I think these kinds of online spaces are still really important today. People go on Reddit to get reviews of products that they think are like from real people and not from bots, which is also increasingly debated. But also they're looking for information on Wikipedia and all these other spaces, right, that are community facilitated and managed. And kind of in the downstream, a lot of these public online forums and sites are also the source of a lot of training data that's shaping new technologies that are coming out. And so it really does deeply matter what kind of content and behavior communities are saying is okay on the internet. And I think this kind of points to my second reason, which is that online communities are indeed a really interesting level of decision making, where people like you and me can try to make some normative claims about online interaction, like basically saying like, hey, we think this kind of content or behavior is not acceptable. We think that information should be shared in a certain way, and so on. And so I think that communities provide this interesting opportunity for intervention in a lot of these broader systems that shape our like online life. When I was in grad school, I talked a lot about platforms and communities. And I used to say that communities were interesting because they can both defer to and subvert the platforms that they're on. And so this raises all these complicated questions about responsibility and who has power, right? I think.
Yeah. And do you think, how do you think this has shaped our experience as users on those platforms? And do you think most people are aware of those big questions in those spaces, or there is a lack of familiarity of how those things play in those large platforms?
Yeah, I think for the most part, users and everyday people don't think too much about it. And I actually think that people often underestimate what it takes to run an online community, in part because I think even now we sometimes think that online doesn't mean real, but it is real, right? Like it's really embedded into our everyday lives. I think I want to point to this really great paper by Professor Hanlin Lee at UT Austin from years ago. And basically in this work, she provides an estimate of how much value the volunteer community moderators on Reddit provide to the platform. And if I remember right, they're using public logs that keep track of moderation tasks these communities are doing. And they estimate something like $3.4 million that the volunteer communities are providing to the platform. And this is just like a very conservative estimate, right? Like, there's so many tasks that are not logged in these public logs. And there's also like, they're using like a pretty low rate of like value per hour of how much time everything is taking and what that's worth. And I think the conclusion is that, you know, people really are putting in the work. It's not just about moderating content and behavior, but also thinking about things like, how do I make the community fun and enjoyable and meaningful and useful for people? How do I shape the newcomer experience so that people want to stay? And what tools do we need to build to help automate some of this so it's manageable, especially if I'm running like a really big community? And I think the questions people are asking are these really basic questions about how to be in community together that when it works, you don't really think about, right? And it's when it breaks down that people notice.
Yes, and one of your recent papers asks a very like deceptively simple question, where do the rules in online communities actually come from? And before getting into what you found, what made you realize that was even a question worth asking? What was the received wisdom and why did it feel incomplete?
Yeah, I like this question mostly because I am really excited about this paper. It's coming out at a conference later this year and is like the fruit of many years of labor from the research group I was a part of in grad school. So the paper in question was led by the wonderful Dr. Charles Keane, and we were in a research group together in grad school called the Community Data Science Collective. And for many years, a lot of us had been thinking about governance, rules, and online communities. You know, the basic intuition is that online communities can be super diverse, right, in their goals and norms. And so we should really expect to see that their rules are very different as well. And there is this really good paper from 2019 that maps out this immense heterogeneity in norms and values on Reddit. So largely it is true, right? Like I don't expect my knitting community to have the same rules as my research paper community, right? But if you hang out in these spaces long enough and you're looking at these rules, you start to see that a lot of the written rules themselves are like suspiciously similar. Many open source communities have adopted the exact same contributor covenant. A lot of the subreddits have the same basic rules, especially when they're on similar topics. And Wikipedia language editions all have their own rule sets, but a lot of these are actually explicitly linked together as parallel or equivalent rules. Like every Wikipedia has something about neutral point of view, right? And I think you could kind of argue that maybe there's like some top-down forces here that the platform is imposing on them. But this isn't really that satisfying either because, you know, again, we do see heterogeneity, right? And it also doesn't give us any insight into how communities might come up with better rules that would help their communities thrive in the ways that they want. And so we decided, okay, let's figure out what communities are actually doing to come up with these rules and what kinds of goals and priorities that are they juggling when they are doing so.
It's interesting because in a way, like tying that back into the broader political realm, you know, people sometimes feel they don't have so much power. They just vote in those elections every few years and you know, that's it. That's their contribution to the political governance of our nation state. Mm-hmm. But then and that probably reflects on the users to also feel, well, the platform is something I enjoy and I use as entertainment or as a communication outlet, but rarely think I do have an influence and I can have a degree of influence in how those things develop. So this is very interesting to think of how much people learn about power and decision-making through those experiences and how that reflects in the broader sense of empowerment regarding our political economy.
Yeah, and I think online communities are a really interesting space for us to explore this because like the basic questions are the same, but there are all these constraints in online spaces about how to say it, like because these are volunteer-based spaces, like there's not a lot of resources, there's not a lot of time that people have. And so they have to make like a lot of trade-offs all the time. And part of those trade-offs is thinking about, okay, is it manageable for me to implement like democratic decision-making in my community? When should I make, you know, these executive calls about how the community should deal with this problem? And so I think it becomes like these like mini experiments in like exercising a muscle of being in society with each other.
Yes, that remind me of a short essay Nathan Schneider wrote a few years ago on the language of involvement. We still need to find that language to communicate the expectations of involvement in having democratic organizations, both online and offline, in which you have the opportunity to govern, to make decisions, to participate. But if we have a scenario where everything in our lives require a high level of engagement, we're going to be left with very little free time for leisure, for anything else, you know, but how we communicate that level of involvement and make sure that as more or as little as you can participate, that opportunity to be a part of that governance body, it's still a possibility.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And that's very interesting in how we articulate that level of involvement from different, from people that are content moderators or just users in the platform, but want to have a say in how things develop in that architecture.
Right. Yeah. It looks like almost like a matter of how much attention do people feel like they can afford to allocate to this decision making, and how much do they feel like they can trust someone else to do that decision making for them?
I think this is key in those spaces, because it's not, sometimes people find a shortcut to say, well, people are not going to have time or interest to participate, therefore this shouldn't be an option. We shouldn't invest in this because people will not necessarily care. And I think this is the mistake. It's about building structures, platforms, organizations that allow for people to be a participant if they want to. That door is open, but there's different levels of engagement, different levels of involvement, and that option is there. I think that's something key in building that type of infrastructure, both online and offline. And your research found that communities don't just write their own rules from scratch. They also borrow, copy, and customize rules from other communities, often in ways that are as much about the social signaling as practical problem solving. You describe this as the relational origins of rules. Can you walk us through what that means and what it reveals about how governance actually works in these spaces?
Yeah, so normally we think of rules as having some kind of practical use, right? Like I might have a rule about harassment so that I can moderate and warn people from acting in certain ways. Or, you know, we might come up with a rule about self-promotion after a bunch of people start to advertise maybe sketchy products in our community or something. But rules in online communities also have what we call relational purposes, like signaling what the community is quote unquote like about, or reinforcing its legitimacy to other communities in that space. And I think the way to think about it is that, you know, often we might think of online communities as contained spaces, right? But actually, online communities exist with many other online communities. And one of my long-term collaborators, Professor Nate Tabuntais, did a lot of really wonderful empirical work sketching out how this happens, and that you can actually see clusters of very similar communities and like the dynamics moving across them. So rules do relational work in these ecologies in two ways. I think first, it can provide a signal that a community belongs to that specific ecosystem. For example, like in Reddit, a community can signal like not only that it's a real Reddit community by adopting some of the very common rules, you know, like don't be a jerk or something like that. Or even within Reddit, it can also signal what kind of Reddit community it is. For example, there's a lot of Reddit communities and some of them have conflicting values. So a community might want to say like, hey, we're part of this part of Reddit, not that other part. And then I think the other relational work that rules do for communities is actually distinguish themselves from one another. So if you and I each run our own communities about podcasts, we probably want to show that we're different in some way, right? Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in like a competitive dynamic, competing for eyeballs and community members. And I think to illustrate this point is like, one of my very first studies actually really speaks to this, where my co-author and I were really interested in why people participate in small communities. And the thing we found was that small communities do this thing where they're really distinguishing themselves. They're making themselves super specific, like hyper specific in their norms in just the right way that catch a following. And then people are able to use the small communities as a complementary space to a bunch of other communities. And I think what's happening there is then people are basically curating a bunch of online experiences to have like a perfect cocktail of the online interactions that they want. And so maybe to your question about what this reveals about governance in these spaces, I think that what we're basically doing with community governance and in online communities and stuff is like trying to carve out expectations of what's otherwise this really ambiguous blob in the ether, right? Like in the small communities paper, we talked about how communities basically partition the information landscape of Reddit, which is the context we were studying, so that it's easier for people to find content and the kinds of interactions that they want. And I feel like more broadly, a lot of my work has tried to think through this, you know, like how can community governance really like operationalize governance in a way that defines and transforms the online spaces we're a part of.
I think this is extremely relevant when you think about the capacity of aligning expectations that protocols provide. As people come from different cultural backgrounds, especially in the internet, people are there from all over the world with very distinct life experiences and expectations, values. And when you leave it all up to interpretation, we might not find that alignment naturally. And that's why it's important to have, you know, thoughtful protocols that serve that purpose of aligning that the expectations and what's the value in that community, what are violations in that community, and that's very helpful to find the language to address those for sure. You conducted in-depth interviews with those community leaders across three very different platforms, right? Reddit, Fandom, and Fediverse. What did it feel like to be inside those conversations? These are volunteer moderators, often making consequential community-shaping decisions in their spare time with very limited tools, like you mentioned. What struck you about how they understood their own work?
Yeah, so I think when I talk to people about their community moderation work, not just in those three platforms, but other ones, what often really strikes me is how unquestioning they are about the value of it. And I'm not saying this because I think it's like, I think it's surprising that they think it's valuable. No, it's just that there's so many things that are stacked against them, right? Like, I think we were talking about this a little earlier, you know, there's so little support or tooling. It is super thankless work. Burnout is pretty well documented in online community moderation and community work in general. And a lot of the technologies or platforms that people are running these communities on are not always necessarily putting community priorities or values first. And I think in recent years, there has been a lot of like fairly high profile cases where a lot of communities realize that the platforms they're on are actually like directly against their interests in some ways. But people do the work anyways. And I think it speaks to how people really do look for community and care about building it. And we're just kind of continuing to struggle through it and trying to find better versions of it.
It's interesting to think about like the comment you made earlier on the value they're actually delivering, but that doesn't get back to them. That's unfortunate that we fail to recognize people's time and effort and dedication, those spaces, and the value they are giving to the community, to the broader economy. And so, well, let's zoom out to the infrastructure level. You've been studying the Fediverse, a network of independently run social media servers that can talk to each other through shared tools and shared protocols. And you've developed a framework for comparing four major decentralized social media protocols: ActivityPub, which underlies Mastodon, AT Protocol, which underlies Blue Sky, Nostr, and Farcaster. One of your central arguments is that decentralization isn't one thing. These systems have very different ideas about what it actually means. So what are the most important differences and why they do matter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe we should start with what a protocol is first. So I know you mentioned it earlier, and I think like a more social definition of a protocol is a set of rules that lays out some kind of proper procedure, conduct, basically outlines conventions of behavior, right? I think here we mean protocol in a technical sense, right? And a technical definition of a protocol is a set of rules that establish how two systems might communicate or exchange data. And a lot of our modern internet is actually built on protocols, you know, email, the World Wide Web. I think recently one thing that's made people really excited is MCP, the Model Context Protocol, that enables large language models to connect with, you know, external systems and data tools and stuff. What is exciting about protocol-based systems is that they're based on open standards that anyone can build on. And so they're meant for many people to like build software for them, encouraging a much more decentralized and like software diverse ecosystem than, say, a platform model like Facebook or TikTok, right? And in recent years, we've seen the rise of decentralized social media in particular. So folks might have heard about Mastodon and Blue Sky, which became pretty popular around 2022 after some ownership changes with Twitter to X. And these are protocol-based systems that allow people like you to own the servers we use to join the network at large, which means we also own our data and we also make decisions about how to own that data, right? In the work that you're referring to, we are trying to think through what these protocols were actually decentralizing, because there's a lot of protocols that have emerged. And some of this was in response to broader critiques in the community that, you know, ActivityPub isn't as decentralized as they say it is, or @Proto actually isn't as decentralized as they say it is. I think the bigger takeaway that we have in the paper is that the protocols we looked at each make different trade-offs about where to decentralize. And those decisions basically reflect what the protocol designers think are an important like point of intervention and trade-off that they're willing to make. So like, for example, continuing the Mastodon Blue Sky case, because I think that'll be more familiar to people. Moderation on those two platforms look pretty different because of the way the protocol decides who can make moderation decisions. Like on Mastodon, it's a bit more like Reddit, where it's across distributed servers and a lot of moderation decisions are happening at the server level. But on Blue Sky, it's a bit more of a hybrid model where the person running the infrastructure, which in practice tends to be mostly one service by Blue Sky, is making some key choices. And the protocol is designed such that it's kind of difficult for a lot of people to be running that big server. At the same time, individual users have this extra layer of third-party services that they can subscribe to do moderation work.
That's great. Your framework for comparing these protocols focuses on three key questions of power. Who controls your identity, your account, your social graph, your history? Who controls curation, what do you see in your feed? And who controls the infrastructure itself? What did you find when you looked at each of those? And were there any answers that surprised you?
Yeah, I think when we were looking through and thinking about these different questions of power, the conclusion that we basically came to is that having a 1000% decentralized system is super hard because you need to balance other aspects like usability or convenience that would make people want to use the system, right? And I think we came away from this thinking that there is basically no perfect way to decentralize. But it also made me think about, or like the question now makes me think about a few weeks ago, I was running a panel here with Andres, who is the faculty I work with here at Princeton in the HCI group. And the panel was on protocols. And we had one of our panelists, was Mike Masnick, who is the founder and runs TechDirt, and is also in my mind very well known because I love his essay Protocols Not Platforms. Anyways, we were talking about how protocols can make all these consequential decisions about, you know, who owns the infrastructure, who can like own a curation layer and all this other stuff. And then that's kind of it. It doesn't really tell you how to solve the problem of, you know, a concentration of power that happens because the protocol designers made a trade-off, essentially, right? Like, it doesn't tell you how to make controlling or making decisions about core infrastructure more accessible to a broader range of people. It doesn't make it easier for people to figure out how to, like, own their own ways of curating or moderating online. But on the panel, Mike said something along the lines of, you know, a protocol should be necessary, but not sufficient. And that really resonated with me, I think, because, you know, one might think, oh, I guess the protocol designers or developers think that this is a fine trade-off and that this is the way that things should be. But actually what a protocol is doing, like a technical protocol is doing, is simply providing a way of exchanging data, right? So it's just one opening point to decentralizing decision-making and power. And making an actually robust ecosystem comes with what comes after that, right? What's built on top of the protocol and around the protocol. So the work is not really over because you've established a protocol or just because you have a protocol-based system. You really need to keep building new infrastructure and, kind of most importantly, keep doing the work of organizing together around it.
And the way we build technology encodes values and power relationships, whether we intended or not. What are the politics you found embedded in this infrastructure? And what's the risk of not being able to see them?
I think more than like a definite politics being strictly embedded in this infrastructure or like in the protocols, the argument that we wanted to make is that different ideas about how power should be distributed or decentralized are playing out in this broader movement of decentralized social media. And I think that's important to note because I think that movement is seen as a pretty homogenous response to all these persistent woes of centralized social media, but actually it is a very vibrant and diverse space of different types of solutions people are trying to think through. And it is very active, right? What's important about being able to see the politics in these kinds of infrastructures and be fairly clear-eyed about them is that it tells us what we might need, what we might do to try to organize or what we should build next. Like if I'm making a trade-off about infrastructure in favor of usability, like maybe we say only one server really holds all the data because that just makes it easier to discover content or something. But if we're making that trade-off, what additional points of intervention do we need to build out or make possible so that people who own or have access to infrastructure can be held accountable? Like, right, like they've got this concentration of power. So how do we counter that power? And one of the projects that we're doing now with communities on the ActivityPub protocol in particular is kind of thinking through, okay, what are some new opportunities that we have given the way that this protocol operates and distributes decision making? And in the ActivityPub protocol in particular, a lot of power goes to server owners. And the thing about that is that, you know, anyone in theory can run a server, but not everyone does because you need a little bit of technical know-how and it also is time and effort that not everyone is willing to put in. And then also the servers also vary, right? Like if I'm a very large server, then I have outsized influence in the network and stuff. But there's also this dynamic where once you recognize that there's a network of servers making a lot of very similar decisions, and sometimes those decisions affect one another because they are networked together, you can find that there's some real opportunities for communities to coordinate and cooperate together. And one of our main projects here has been kind of trying to build out these opportunities for coordination and cooperation. And this has been in partnership with Bonfire Networks, which is this really cool collective of developers building community-first software for the ActivityPub protocol. So shout out to Yvonne and Mael if they're listening. But yeah, I can talk more about that project if you want, but
please, please do. What's exciting about it now?
I think what is really exciting about that project is thinking about how communities can govern together and share some of the effort and labor of this governance work. So when we think about coordination across a bunch of communities, I think what we're really hoping to do is enable communities to build coalitions that reduce their burden of governing so that governing is more sustainable, right? Like communities have a lot of shared problems, or they might be just dealing with similar organizational questions. And so one of the really important things to do is let them discover each other and learn from each other, and also perhaps help each other if they feel like one community has extra capacity for governing and there's like a similar community that they like that they want to help out. We ran some design workshops last year because some of this work had come out of, you know, both conversations that we had been having with people, but also from the earlier discussions I was talking about with like the relational nature of community governance. And so we were running some design workshops last year with these communities, and we have a paper out that came out last month that kind of summarizes what happened in these workshops, where people were really starting to sketch out this new vision of community infrastructure for supporting more of a collaborative, coordinated vision for community governance of the internet.
Can you share, kind of encapsulate what type of infrastructure we need? What are important components abstractly we need in that infrastructure?
Yeah, I think one of the things that really stuck out to me was this idea of a shared language of governance. It came up over and over again, right? That we all have some intuitions about governance in these online spaces, but no one can really quite agree on what the actual words are to use and how to describe what they're doing. And everyone's doing it in slightly different ways that make it pretty difficult to coordinate on anything. And so one of the like first steps of projects we're building out is trying to devise what a shared language of governance might look like for an open social web. And some of that is about building like a technical infrastructure. So like something like a data schema that communities can use to kind of quickly share information about. But a lot of this is also organizational, right? Like this is basically trying to make some kind of cultural, social shifts in how we think about and the language that we use to talk about governance work in online spaces that is largely invisible to everyday people.
I find this fascinating because one of our projects at MedLab called Governance Ecologies, we're trying to map different governance experiences across communities all over the world, especially in the global South, and trying to understand not only their values, but their institutions and mechanisms. And one challenge in that project is to find that shared language in which we can compare, you know, pears with pears, bananas with bananas, because sometimes what one group, one community means by council or committee or commission has a widely different definition than the other one. And to bring legibility to those different institutions and mechanisms is definitely one of the key challenges in mapping those governance experiences. And here I'm talking about traditional communities, indigenous communities, rural communities. We're looking at a broad range of what we consider a community, not only in the online space, but offline as well. And that challenge persists even in that context, finding that shared language. So I find it incredibly valuable building that shared understanding in terms of governance, not just online, but hopefully offline as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think also as an academic, it's exciting because in a way you're trying to think about basic theories about governance, right? Like what is the essence or like fundamental piece of governance that shapes how we coordinate behavior and how we incentivize people to cooperate. I think those are all really fundamental things that I see the practical value of it in these projects, but as an academic, I also get really excited by the basic questions.
Yes, that's also a lot what I see, a lot of synergy with our work, because that's also part of things we're developing in establishing dispute resolution protocols across communities or within communities, also find ways to help communities building their own rules. So we have a project called Community Rule that is designed to help small, medium-sized communities or even large communities to understand what types of decision-making and rules and values they can embed into their protocols. So that's it's definitely very complementary. And across all of your work, there is a recurring pattern. Systems are designed to distribute power, but in practice, power tends to reconcentrate somewhere. In a company, in a few dominant servers, in a small group of overworked volunteer moderators. Is there a way out of that cycle? When you imagine communities where people genuinely have collective decision-making power, not just on paper, but in practice, what does that actually look like?
So I may have a slightly depressing sounding answer, but one that I want to say I think is more hopeful than it feels like. Basically, no. In many ways, I don't think that there is a real way out of this cycle. I think that our decisions about organizing, governing, socializing, all this stuff, they're always going to jostle power around over and over and over again, because we're going to decide that some arrangement is not perfect and then try something else. And I think the thing that I always go back to is that governance is not an outcome or end state. We should think of it as a process. And I feel that we very generally are always on this pendulum swing of iterating and refining what good governance should look like. The reason why I want to argue this is less depressing than it sounds like, because otherwise it feels like a never-ending journey, right? Is that I think it means that we can always think about ourselves as having capacity for change. And I think this is actually like a really hopeful way of thinking about it. Like, here I'm kidnapping some ideas from political and institutional theorists who have inspired a lot of how I see these problems. Basically, so much of designing good institutions and good governance systems is about developing a system that can withstand and adapt to change in the long term, and that can evolve in ways that still support a stable society. And, I think sometimes now it really seems like a moment that we need capacity for change. And so a lot of my work, ongoing work, and I think the projects that we're going to focus on this year is really going to be focused on this question of, how can communities govern sustainably? Like, if we really care about people having more voice and power in these systems, if we care about opening up and democratizing all these evolving and emerging technologies, what we need to do is make sure that the work of community governance around them is not only possible, but can endure, evolve, and adapt, right? And I don't just mean for online communities or platforms. I think this really applies to all sorts of technologies that are spreading into our lives.
That's fantastic. I love that. And I mean, just one last question. Our show is called Looks Like New. We are always looking for the old question underneath the new technology. So your work, rules, legitimacy, collective governance, who gets to decide, is really about a very, very ancient problem. How groups of people govern themselves together, especially when they have unequal power and competing interests. What's the old question you think you're really asking? And does being able to name that question change how you approach the new technology?
I think in a way, all I do is ask old questions. But maybe for this one, I'll talk about one that I'm thinking about more recently. Because I think the very old and basic question is maybe about trust. When we talk about governance, like, how can we trust one another so that we can live well and live better together? And I think when we think about it in this way, what it does is break down the idea of technology design as a technical problem into a much more social one. In my field, there's this idea of the socio-technical, right? Like, the social shapes the technical shapes the social, and those are kind of inextricably intertwined. And I think trust really puts an emphasis on the social here. Like when we see problems that technology seems to bring into our lives, the question often is a social one.
I actually do have a follow-up on this. I find it fascinating because nowadays, when we look at blockchain development, for example, it's sold as trustless technology. It's trying to remove the trust component from the equation. How do you feel about that? Are we able to trustless technology?
I think that in blockchain, the idea of trustless actually may be quite different than what we envision as trust. I'm not super familiar with like the blockchain space, but I have been talking with folks more recently because in the fall, I'll be joining the D-Center, which does a lot of work on blockchain here at Princeton. And one of the things that the folks there keep emphasizing to me is that the ideas about security and like trustless systems in blockchain are really divorced from our more quotidian ideas about security and trust. And that is often where misconceptions about blockchain as a technology seems to arise and what people believe that blockchain can do for them.
Great. Well, this was really inspiring. And I thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to keep following your work and your research. And thank you. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.